Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. The murder of American Paul Johnson Jr. on Friday in Saudi Arabia comes after a bloody month for foreigners in the kingdom. This month and a year of suicide bombings and brutal shootouts at the hands of Islamic terror groups has left the world wondering how seriously the Saudi government is cracking down on terror. Tonight on Point, Saudi Arabia's battle with its homegrown terrorists. But first, we turn to Iraq, where Islamic militants threatened to behead South Korean Kim Son-il tonight if South Korea did not abandon plans to send 3,000 more troops to Iraq. Matthew McAllister is Middle East correspondent for Newsday. I asked him for the latest on Kim Son-il.
We don't know whether he's alive or dead. The 24-hour deadline set by the kidnappers, believed to be connected to Sarkad Marsawi, seems to be either up by this stage or just about to be up. And the only way that we really find out about these things is through tapes that kidnappers tend to release to the Arab TV networks. And so we can only wait and see what happens. And if tomorrow there's no tape, well, that'll be good news, probably.
Do we know whether there have been any attempts to secure his release in a military operation or indeed through mediation?
Through mediation, I understand that the company that he works for, the Korean company, which has been supplying supplies to the American military, they apparently have been working through an Iraqi intermediary to try and secure his release. And they're also saying that there are a number of other hostages taken at the time or already in custody of these militants.
You mention Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, the Jordanian-born Islamic militant. He is believed, to be active in the kidnapping of foreigners in Iraq?
He is, and in fact, in this particular case, the kidnappers in the video that we've mostly seen, his name comes up in it. He's connected to this group. At least that's what the video suggests. The American military strongly believe, I think, according to press conferences here, the briefings, that he is in and around Fallujah, perhaps, or at least his supporters are. They also believe he was connected with the beheading of Nicholas Berg. So there seem to be two forces, militant forces, within Fallujah. One is Zarqawi's and the people related to al-Qaeda and the more Islamist, and another more indigenous sort of Mujahideen type force that's the essentially Fallujans who are fed up of what's happening and been happening to their town. The Americans dispute that distinction, but I, from what I'm hearing on the ground, there are two groups in there, and unfortunately, the Korean contractor has ended up in the hands of the less compromising group, because the other group, the sort of Fedayeen Mujahideen types, have indeed released people in the past quite regularly.
And, of course, the threat to kill Kim Son-il came the day after the U.S. Military strike on Fallujah.
Yeah, and it's terribly bad timing for him. I mean, awfully bad luck in that sense, because things, in fact, had been relatively quiet in Fallujah since the terrible battle about 10 or 11 weeks ago. And it's never easy there, but things had quietened down. And then here's this airstrike, and, of course, with apparently roughly 20 people killed in this attack, the passions will be very, very high there, and whoever's holding Mr. Son-il will be less inclined to show him clemency than they would have if this attack had not happened, I would imagine.
Can you tell us any more about the discovery of the bodies of four U.S. Marines today in Ramadi, west of Baghdad?
It's a little sketchy and mysterious at this stage. The reports are that they were found spread on the ground. Now, you know, beyond that, the U.S. military is not being very forthcoming about the details. Now, Ramadi, again, is no piece of cake for the U.S. military. Everyone talks about Fallujah, but a little further west, there's just this other hotbed. And it's unsurprising in a sense that there will be casualties out there. There have been continually casualties there, as there have been around and in Fallujah.
Iraq's interim government is said to be considering imposing a state of emergency. What would that involve?
It would involve curfews in some areas, I believe. But I think a lot of it is posturing. I mean, there is a distinct lack of capability. A lot of people here think, among the security forces, that the new interim government would be taking control of. And how exactly they would impose martial law. I mean, when we think about martial law, we think about a Saddam-era type government or you know, a very strong army and police force that could, in fact, impose it. Well, the police force and Iraqi army, as is at the moment, you know, can't control basic crime issues. So how they would impose martial law is a bit of a mystery. It's something that has been bandied around, and if it happens, what form it'll take will surprise a lot of people around here as to whether it's effective or not.
Matthew McAllister in Baghdad, many thanks.
Thank you.
Matthew McAllister is Middle East correspondent for Newsday. Hours after the brutal slaying of American Paul Johnson Jr. by a group of Islamic terrorists in Saudi Arabia on Friday, Saudi officials shot dead the leader of the Al-Qaeda-inspired group that killed Johnson, Abdulaziz Al-Mughrin. But Al-Mughrin wasn't an unknown. He'd served time in a Saudi jail after an attempt on the life of Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak in Ethiopia in 1995. His eight-year sentence was cut in half and he was released after impressing his guards by memorizing the entire Quran. Al-Mughrin's story is an indication of how the Saudis have fought terror, or rather not fought terror, in the past. But in the wake of what Saudi Arabia calls its own 9/11, May the 12th, 2003, when three suicide bombs tore through Riyadh, killing 34 people, the kingdom, experts say, has made some strides towards cracking down on terror and the financing of terror groups, but not enough. Tonight on Point, Saudi Arabia's battle with its homegrown terrorists. Does it seem to you that the Saudi government is losing the war against terrorism? What does that mean for the global war on terror? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us from Washington is Jonathan Shanzer, a fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy and an expert on radical Islamic movements. He's author of the forthcoming book, Al-Qaeda's Armies, Middle East Affiliate Groups, and the Next Generation of Terror. Jonathan Shanzer, I mean, who are these militants in Saudi Arabia, and are they part of the Al-Qaeda network?
Well, the answer to that is yes, but not entirely. Many of these insurgents are people who are part of the Wahhabist sect that Saudi Arabia has been cultivating over the years. In fact, what a lot of people point to right now is that this upsurge in violence is what we would call blowback here in the United States. After the U.S. Helped support the Mujahideen to fight the Soviets in Afghanistan, some of those insurgents went on to become al-Qaeda and attacked us. The same could be said for what happened to the Israelis when they supported Hamas in the mid-1980s. And then, of course, Hamas turned around and began attacking Israel after the Intifada began in 1987. What we're seeing right now in Saudi Arabia is a similar blowback situation. So some of them are local, homegrown Islamists, and then some of them, I would say that a large portion of the people who were involved in al-Mughrin's cell, those people served time in Afghanistan. They were part of the Taliban regime, came back to Saudi Arabia afterwards, and are now attacking the Saudis.
But what links, if any, does someone like Abdulaziz Al-Mughrin have with Osama bin Laden? Does he act autonomously, or does he act under instructions?
Well, he acts autonomously, but what he is essentially an overachiever who graduated from the al-Qaeda training camps and from the al-Qaeda wars, and has gone back to do Osama bin Laden's bidding in his own country. What we're seeing around the world right now, most of the core of al-Qaeda has been largely defeated. Many people have been killed. Many people have been put in jail. And then, of course, you have people like Ayman al-Zawahiri or Osama bin Laden who are essentially hiding in caves and behind rocks in Pakistan or Afghanistan. So the core of al-Qaeda is largely gone, but what they've done, beginning in the late 1990s, They began to cultivate affiliate groups, and these affiliate groups spread the entire Muslim world. There are about two or three dozen of them at this point. And these people act autonomously. They essentially act in the name of al-Qaeda, in the ideology of al-Qaeda, without necessarily getting directives. What they'll do is they'll either have training from the Corps or perhaps have received money or weapons.
You see, Abdulaziz al-Mukrim was doing the bidding of Osama bin Laden in Saudi Arabia. Is that to bring down the Saudi royal family?
Without a doubt. The Saudi royal family has been in the crosshairs of Osama bin Laden since the very beginnings of the al-Qaeda network, really beginning in the late 1980s and early 1990s. Osama bin Laden began to openly condemn the Saudi regime, particularly for having U.S. Forces on its soil after the 1991 Gulf War. But that has not really stopped Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda from continuing to hammer it at the Saudi regime, even after last year our soldiers were removed.
You describe the Saudi government's somewhat ambivalent attitude towards Wahhabism. You talk about this blowback effect that is currently taking place. But is the government as a whole now, do you think, dedicated to fighting this insurgency in Saudi Arabia?
I would say that the results are mixed at this point. Looking back to what you called their 9/11, their May 12th attacks of last year, they began a PR campaign, a propaganda campaign to combat the ideals of radical Islam, turning on Al Jazeera or Al Arabiya or some of the other channels in the Arab world, some of these satellite stations. You can see some Saudi commercials, and the tagline is, "Yes to Islam, no to terrorism." And this, by and large, I think, was their foremost response to their attacks of last year. Yes, there was increased cooperation with the FBI on the ground in Riyadh, and yes, there was an increased vigilance for radicals within the kingdom. But I don't think that there was a frank discussion about who it was that actually carried out these attacks and what it was that the Saudis needed to do, in fact, to destroy them. As recently as 3 or 4 weeks ago, one of the members of the Saudi royal family blamed recent attacks on Zionists. Now, I can tell you with basic certainty that that there were probably no Israelis on Saudi soil, and I'm fairly certain that they did not carry attacks out against the Saudi kingdom. What we're seeing is really radical Islamists that are carrying out these attacks, and the Saudis have yet to really look this in the eye and to say, we know exactly what we're dealing with, and this is going to have to be, at the end of the day, a challenge of moderate Muslims against radical ones, and the Saudis have yet to come to terms with that.
But insofar as that branch of Islam known as Wahhabism might be described as the state religion in Saudi Arabia, it's fair to assume, is it, that maybe some members of these Saudi security forces share the same kinds of aims as these militants?
I would say without a doubt that there would be people within the Saudi royal family, within the military, within various arms of the Saudi government. What I would describe right now that's happening inside Saudi Arabia is there is literally a battle between good and evil going on. We're not hearing about it to the same extent that perhaps we're hearing about the battle between the reformers and the mullahs in Iran. But there seems to be at least a bit of a challenge being posed to the radicals right now. There are reformers within the Saudi regime. Without getting into names, I think it's really not very helpful to look at which princes are part of the problem and which princes are part of the solution. But I would say that there does seem to be a challenge right now that's taking place within the kingdom.
But it's not as if hastened reform would stop the actions of these Islamic militants.
No, not at all. I think, in fact, it would probably embolden the militants to continue to carry out attacks because they would see their hold on the country perhaps being threatened.
So the only option open to the Saudi authorities is a military solution?
I believe it would be a military solution coupled with reform, and I think also an increased transparency on the part of the Saudi kingdom. Until now, the Saudis have shrouded their entire government in mystery. The Saudi people do not have any say in their government whatsoever. It is a rentier economy, which means that other countries pay the Saudis for oil, and therefore the Saudis don't need to collect taxes, and thus the Saudi people don't have any say in their government. So essentially, all of these things put together have created this atmosphere where radical Islam is allowed to grow unfettered on the ground, and the Saudis have not done much in the way of asking for help from anyone to try to put this down. Now, this does not necessarily mean that they have to come right to the United States and ask for help. They can go to other countries, they can ask the Egyptians, they can ask the Jordanians, but I do believe that at this point they're going to need some outside help. They've created really a monster within their own country.
Jonathan Chancer, do stay with us. We're talking tonight about how well Saudi Arabia is taking on the fight against Al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups. If you were in Saudi Arabia, would you leave? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight about how well Saudi Arabia is taking on the fight against Al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups. Today, after Paul Johnson Jr.'s death, are you less concerned with Osama bin Laden or with Al-Qaeda splinter groups? Is the Saudi government doing enough to crack down on terror? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking to Jonathan Chancer, a fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy and author of the forthcoming book, Al-Qaeda's Armies, Middle East Affiliate Groups and the Next Generation of Terror. And joining us now is Jonathan Weiner, former Deputy Assistant U.S. Secretary of State for International Law Enforcement during the Clinton administration and co-author of a recent Council on Foreign Relations report on Saudi Arabia's handling of terrorist financing. And Jonathan Weiner, what's your verdict on the Saudi government's handling of terrorist financing?
Well, now or 10 years ago or last month or last year?
Let's have it now.
Now it's substantially better than it was. Whether it's enough, it's too soon to say. The problem is there's no accountability for the past, and that is a really big problem.
But you do say that there is a lot more to be done.
Well, on paper, since May 12, 2003, when they had their own terrorist attacks in Riyadh, which they have referred to as their own September 11th, which would suggest that they didn't understand September 11th and its meaning prior to that, they have comprehensively enacted laws to give themselves an anti-money laundering and terrorist finance regime that is as good as that of any country in the world on paper. Now, I say on paper because it is, as my colleague said a minute ago, very hard to tell what goes on inside Saudi Arabia. The Saudis are not very good at accountability, and they're terrible at transparency. So when they say something has happened, you can choose to believe them. You can choose to disbelieve them, but you've got no factual way of knowing whether the belief and faith in the Saudis or the disbelief in the Saudis is the correct position. You may not know for years.
And another gray area, as far as you're concerned, is the continuation of the export of radical extremism, the global propagation of Wahhabism.
Well, the Saudis made a conscious decision in the early 1990s to essentially bring everybody into the tent. It was to say that they would fund essentially Islamic movements all over the world. They funded it against genocide. They funded it against ethnic cleansing in Kosovo and Bosnia, genocide from their perspective in Chechnya. And in the course of all of that funding, they also funded, largely unwittingly, the foundations of Al-Qaeda and the building of Al-Qaeda all over the world. Now, they did this on top of a pre-existing network of the Muslim Brotherhood, which had been built over decades previous, but the Saudi money layered on top of it really gave a tremendous amount of energy to what Al-Qaeda was doing. It was part of Saudi foreign policy, although Saudi foreign policy certainly did not intend the terrorist acts, but it was the consequence of what they decided.
And Jonathan Chancer, I think that was what you were talking about earlier, the blowback effect.
Yeah, this blowback, I would say, actually is probably best seen in the Saudi funding of the Islamic Jihad and Gamal Islamiyah groups of Egypt during an offensive against communism in the 1970s and 1980s. The Saudis pumped a lot of money into Egypt in particular to try to combat communism on campus. The groups that they funneled the money into were the Islamic Jihad and Gamal Islamiyah, which, as we all know, eventually went on to become the foundation, the very core of Al-Qaeda. In fact, most of the people who are now responsible for the attacks of 9/11, the planning, et cetera, most of them were Egyptians, including Ayman al-Zawahiri, the number one ideologue, and it all came essentially from that Saudi foundation.
Now, Tom's calling from Somerville, Massachusetts, with a question. Tom, what do you want to ask?
I'm wondering,
you know, it seems as though Saudi Arabia is being kind of conveniently targeted as the scapegoat for all of this problem. When I think you look at the Bush administration's foreign policy in recent years, I think if anything, it's made the House of Saud even less stable. And I think if you look at the late 80s, early 90s funding that the Saudis did, that you could argue would bred some of this al-Qaeda stuff, I would argue a lot of it was encouraged by U.S. foreign policy, which was shaped at the time by the Reagan administration, which in turn was sort of created by a lot of these neocons. So I think basically what you have is the neocons now in the Bush White House trying to blame the Saudis for this whole mess. And I'm not disputing the fact that Saudi Arabia has not been a democratic regime, but I think far more of the blowback has its origins in the Reagan administration and now in the Bush 2 administration. And I think it's kind of convenient that these neocons are planting these seeds to get the heat off of themselves.
Jonathan Weiner?
Yeah, forgive me. I think the notion that the neocons are doing this to Saudi Arabia is simply way off base. Now, I'm a former Clinton administration political appointee, and I have no particular use for the people who got us into Iraq. Having said that, I mean, I recently looked at an article from 10 years ago, 1994, a New York Times headline, "Saudis try to curb money aiding Islamic militants." Okay, that's from 1994, April 30th, 1994. Saudis try to curb money aiding Islamic militants. It's not the neocons that are putting this out. The fact is, this is where the money came from to support Islamic extremism all over the world. We were tracking it in the Clinton administration, and there's tons of information that's public now, and it's not about somebody's political agenda. It's a reality. It's not a particularly convenient reality, particularly for the Bush administration because of the ties there. So the notion that allies of the Bush administration are somehow encouraging these attacks on Saudi Arabia just strikes me as wrong factually.
Tom,
there's a problem. We have to deal with the problem.
Tom, your reaction? Are you convinced?
No. I think you go back to the Reagan administration, and I think you see the seeds of this. The neocons were born in the Reagan administration, and I think we're paying for that now.
Okay, Tom in Massachusetts, thanks for that. Elizabeth is calling from Boston. Elizabeth, what would you like to ask?
Well, my question is simply that history shows in similar cases, individuals come to these, I hate to call it a movement, but these forces with their own individual histories, their own agendas. And personally, I just really hate to see Osama bin Laden getting all the credit for organizing this. I hate to see the Saudis being a single force for good or evil. Is there any research yet on who the individuals have been and what has motivated people to join up in these operations?
Jonathan Shanza, that's one for you, I think.
Sure. The research that we've seen thus far about who's been coming to join al-Qaeda around the world, it's very varied. Many people like to say that it has to do with poverty or not having the right opportunities. We're actually finding that many of the people that join these movements are middle class. They have a university background, or perhaps they're artisans. They're carpenters or plumbers, and these are the people that go on to become militants in this movement. But in terms of the people who are joining the movement in Saudi Arabia in particular, we're seeing really two types of people. People that were actually trained through Saudi madrasas or Pakistani madrasas that are, of course, Wahhabi-funded, or people that are graduates of the al-Qaeda camps in Afghanistan. These are the two main groups of people. And while I cannot say that Osama bin Laden can take credit for all these people coming and joining, he essentially, with the help of a man named Abdullah Azam in the late 1980s, helped create this movement. And this movement developed over the years and gained its own sort of momentum. But he is still seen as the figurehead of this movement, and therefore, I think, still can claim quite a bit of credit when people come and join these movements from around the world.
Jonathan Weiner, if I can come to you, Kevin's calling from Fall River in Massachusetts, and I think his is a question that you might want to address.
Yes, sir.
Kevin, go ahead.
Yes. My question is that there's been discussion in various outlets about the ties and of the Bush administration, and in particular the Bush family with Saudi Arabia, with the Saudi royal family, with the bin Laden family. And I'm wondering if that, to the extent that that's the case, to what extent is that an advantage in doing battle with Saudi-based terrorism, and to what extent that might be a disadvantage in so much it might imply conflicts of interest.
Jonathan Wynan?
It's a great question, and let me try and answer as best I can. First of all, I think that government generally ought not to be based on faith, that accountability and transparency are tremendously important in any government. And the U.S.-Saudi relationship, like Saudi Arabian government itself, has tended to be non-accountable and non-transparent for decades, whether the Republicans or the Democrats have been in. Now, the Craig Unger book on House of Bush, House of Saud raises a number of questions about these ties, suggesting conflicts of interest. And I think it's possible that at the political level, the Bush administration has pulled some punches, particularly in the designation of particular Saudi businessmen as terrorist financiers, because of a sense that would make the Saudi government very unhappy. And it's tried to work cooperatively with the Saudi government in order to avoid having to be unhappy. And, of course, all that in the end is about oil and keeping oil flowing and keeping the relationships between these two countries happy, given the oil industry. So I think it is simultaneously something that can be used and potentially a conflict. But I would note that I don't see huge differences between the handling of the Clinton administration in this particular relationship and handling of Bush 1 and Bush 2. In every case, you know, great continuity, there's been lack of accountability and lack of transparency, which I view to be a problem as an American. We forget Republicans, forget Democrats. The one thing that I want the Saudis to do, and it's my one test, and they've flunked this test so far, not gotten a D, it's an F, is arrest people and bring people to trial. Who are responsible for funding terror and for sending funds to terrorist groups. The United States government's got information on that. And not maybe, it does, and it's communicated that to the Saudis. Not maybe, it has. And the Saudis haven't arrested anybody. They haven't seized anybody's assets and made it public, let alone have trials. And the United States government has not hit any what we used to call the Jeddah businessmen or several of the most well-known Saudi charities as terrorist financiers imposing sanctions. I view that as a real lack of accountability in light of September 11th and a serious problem. And forget partisan politics. Regardless of who's in charge, we need to have that transparency and that accountability.
Kevin in Fall River, many thanks for calling here tonight on Point. Is the Saudi government doing enough to crack down on terror? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jonathan Schanzer, a lot of emphasis, a lot of media interest on what is happening in Saudi Arabia. Is there, though, still at the moment elsewhere on the globe a low level of Al-Qaeda-sponsored terrorism?
Certainly. One of the things that I found in my book is that there are affiliate groups, small organic Islamist groups that eventually grew to into the web of Al-Qaeda. Over the years, they are active really across the globe. And I don't mean the sort of cells that we're worried about here in the United States, but I'm talking about groups that are operating in the open that have either openly declared their affinity for the Al-Qaeda network or have people that have graduated from the Al-Qaeda wars and Al-Qaeda camps. The ones that I've looked at in my book are in Lebanon, they're in Algeria, Yemen, Egypt. Of course, we're hearing about the one very often in northern Iraq. And then, of course, I'm a Middle East expert. I don't even follow things that are happening in Asia and Southeast Asia, but we hear a lot about the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan, groups in the Philippines and Indonesia. And the problem really is going to be for local governments, not unlike what the Saudis are going to have to deal with right now. It's about dealing with their local Islamist problem, dealing with these affiliates before they get bigger, before they turn into larger bases of operation, and before they get a chance to overthrow governments or to create or to carry out damaging attacks against either local or Western interests.
Jonathan Wynan, turning to the future after June 30th, the handover in Iraq,
right,
might we expect the Bush administration to start paying a little bit more attention to Saudi Arabia? And if so, in what specific ways do you think it can help government?
Yeah, first of all, the United States government's paying attention to Saudi Arabia. It's not that nobody's paying attention. There is a policy of trying to keep things quiet and calm and cooperating with one another in secret, which makes it very difficult for anyone on the outside to evaluate what's going on. That's the policy, and they're cooperating against terrorist operations in Saudi Arabia and perhaps elsewhere, a little harder to tell elsewhere. The Saudis avoid mostly criticizing the United States, pump out the wonderful things that they're doing. every time they kill a terrorist or agree to some other action. There's a big PR offensive. And I don't see that changing between now and the elections. I think it'll be exactly the same, and it has nothing to do with Iraq. And if you asked me this question 2 years ago, I would have said almost exactly the same thing. And if you asked me this question 4 years ago, or 10, I would have said almost exactly the same thing.
Okay, well, let's take a call now from Anna in Boston. Anna, what's your question?
Hi, I just have a question, a general comment that I would like your guests to comment on as well. It seems to me that Saudi Arabia in general is suffering from bad public relations issues among its own neighbors. For example, Saudi Arabia was not really involved in bringing peace to its neighbors, for example, Yemen or Sudan or parts of Somalia. They've been very isolated. They haven't really done a lot of the sort of the public relations work that, say, Gaddafi had done. So do you think that Saudi Arabia is being attacked not only by its own people but also by fellow neighbors who are very resentful of its kings and whatever not?
Jonathan Shanza?
Well, I think the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia has been its own worst enemy when it comes to public relations. Number one, it was one of three countries to actually recognize the Taliban as a legitimate government in the late 1990s. This was something that was not necessarily smiled upon by its neighbors. As far as Yemen is concerned, it's a country they've been following very closely, and the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia is known to actually pay off various tribal patriarchs to carry out attacks and to sabotage Yemeni government interests. Bahrain and Qatar are also staunch enemies of the Saudis because of territorial disputes and other political issues within Gulf politics. So in other words, I don't necessarily think that the Saudi government has really conducted itself very well on many fronts.
But Jonathan Chanza, could it be that there are militants from Sudan, Yemen, Somalia involved in this insurgency in Saudi Arabia?
Of course, there could be. As a matter of fact, we know that there are some Yemenis that have been caught inside Saudi Arabia. In fact, I think one of the people who were killed, along with Abdulaziz al-Mukran, was part of the USS Cole plot of October of 2000. But by and large, the terrorism problem inside Saudi Arabia has been a Saudi one, and I think other countries are aware of that and are essentially letting the Saudis take care of this on their own.
Jonathan Weiner, just a quick one for you before our break. You talk in terms of this covert cooperation between Washington and Riyadh.
Secret.
It is, though, in your opinion, paying dividends.
In the opinion of people who I trust and respect, some of whom are career and some of whom are Republican political appointees, and I'm a Democrat, it has paid off some substantial dividends since September 11, 2001, and it has also had some substantial limits.
Jonathan Weiner, do stay with us, and you too, Jonathan Shanza. This is On Point. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight about how well Saudi Arabia is taking on the fight against al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups. Do you regard Saudi Arabia as an ally in the war against terror? Do you want the U.S. to turn its attention to Saudi Arabia after its June 30th pullout in Iraq? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight about how well Saudi Arabia is taking on the fight against al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups. Is Saudi Arabia doing enough to fight terror? Could the U.S. do more to fight terror in the kingdom? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking with Jonathan Weiner, former Deputy Assistant U.S. Secretary of State for International Law Enforcement during the Clinton administration, and co-author of a recent Council on Foreign Relations report on Saudi Arabia's handling of terrorist financing. Also with us is Jonathan Shanzer, a fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy and author of the forthcoming book, Al-Qaeda's Armies, Middle East Affiliate Groups and the Next Generation of Terror. And this goes straight to Rafe. He's calling from Lexington in Kentucky. And Rafe, what was your question?
Well, I would like to observe that much of the discussion about the problems in Saudi Arabia missed the point that the root cause of terrorism has many other origins, and not the least of which is the matter of the unbalanced approach that the United States has had relative to the Israeli-Palestinian question. When there's a terrorist, when someone hates you, that is an invitation to introspection.
Jonathan Weiner, the United States could be doing a lot more than simply secretly assisting Saudi Arabia. It could be reformulating its foreign policies if it's to win the war on terror.
Well, certainly it could be. There are a variety of things we could do. Again, I would emphasize the need for accountability and transparency before anything else, because until you know the facts and know that people are being held accountable and are being punished when they've engaged in something like funding terrorism, people continue to believe that they can get away with it and they can do it, and that's kind of all right. Now, the notion that the U.S. approach in the Arab Israeli Palestinian-Israeli situation is at the foundation of al-Qaeda is just historically not correct. Al-Qaeda's roots go back to the Afghan War. You see them building up in a lot of other places, including in Indonesia, in Chechnya, in Bosnia, in Kosovo, in Sudan, that have had very little interest in the Middle Eastern issues. Now, there is an interrelationship between al-Qaeda and Hamas. One of the ideological founders of al-Qaeda also had important Hamas connections, and the Muslim Brotherhood, the organization I mentioned earlier, really is the financial spine, central nervous system, and underpinnings of both movements. But I think they're distinct, and there are a lot of political problems in Saudi Arabia which have fed the development of al-Qaeda. There's no democracy there. There is no accountability of the government to its people, and no way that people with political differences can be heard there. And that's certainly fed it, and that's true in a number of other Arab countries.
Let's just bring Jonathan Shanzer in again and ask him, from what he knows of these militant groups, even if there were to be an equitable solution of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, would there necessarily follow from that a drop-off in Islamic militancy?
Oh, yeah, I would have to agree with Jonathan on this. I would actually date the roots of al-Qaeda and some of these other terrorist groups actually back to 1928, which was when the Muslim Brotherhood was founded in Egypt. The Arab-Israeli conflict was nascent, and no one was really thinking about American involvement. It was actually a response to the British who were in Egypt at the time. But the other thing that I think is important to think about is, you know, if you get a chance to go to some of these Wahhabist mosques, these mosques that have been funded by Saudi Arabia, I've had a chance to see some of them in Egypt and in Jordan and actually even in Suriname, South America. What is taught in those mosques have nothing to do with any conflict between Christians or Jews against Muslims. What is taught in those mosques is chauvinism. It is the idea that Islam is the best religion, it's the only religion, it is the last religion, and therefore all others are infidels and are you know, deserve to be killed. And once people graduate from those mosques, then perhaps they go on to Afghanistan or to Pakistan or to other places and are further radicalized. This is the way the terrorists are molded. I think that, of course, having an equitable solution to the Arab-Israeli conflict could help, you know, in perhaps deterring some terrorists. But I don't necessarily think that it would solve a problem in any way.
Jonathan Weiner, returning to Saudi Arabia itself, if a lot of the underlying tensions in the kingdom can be ascribed to a conflict within the administration between, let's call them, conservatives and reformists, what should not just the United States, but indeed the rest of the world, be doing in order to enhance the hand of the reformists?
Well, my own view is that when you have information about what's actually going on in a government, whether it's your own country or foreign country, you publish it. You make it public so that people can start to know the facts. You don't hide information, because when people don't know what the facts are, they can't respond and take further steps. and the secrecy that has surrounded the U.S.-Saudi relationship for decades has been bad for both countries.
But you think the publication of such information, greater transparency on the part of the Saudi government, would strengthen the hands of the reformists?
Yes, I do. Strongly.
And Jonathan Shanzer, I think we've already dwelt on this point with you somewhat, that even if there were greater moves for reform in Saudi Arabia, it wouldn't necessarily stop the Islamic militancy.
No, I think initially you would probably, as I mentioned before, embolden the terrorists. It would make them want to defend their hold on the country, their stranglehold, which I think they've had really for the last 72 years since the inception of the Saudi state. But I think, as Jonathan mentioned, it would be important, I think, to publish whatever things are happening on the ground in terms of reform so that others would know about it. And then I think at that point, I think the American public might feel better about supporting certain politicians, certain members of the Saudi royal family. We could actually begin to devise at least some sort of a strategy to hand the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia over to reformers. Right now, as Jonathan mentioned, we just really do not know most of what is going on within the internal politics. A lot of what we get are rumors from people who are on the ground, people that have perhaps access to the Saudi royal family, but that's always filtered through others' eyes. So it's extremely difficult for us right now to know exactly what the Saudis are dealing with and how they even want to approach this problem.
As a former Clinton administration appointee, the one criticism I will make directly of the Bush administration is that their penchant for secrecy and the Saudis' penchant for secrecy have fit together hand in glove on this, and it is not in either country's interests. I wish they would both change their approach, and they need to.
Jonathan Shanzer, would, though, a victory, if you can classify it as such, over Islamic militancy in Saudi Arabia have a broader impact on the U.S.-led war on terror?
It would be more monumental, I believe, than a victory in Iraq. Saudi Arabia has long been seen as this epicenter of radical Islam, and what I've been telling people for the last few years since 9/11 is that this war eventually is going to have to be not of the United States against radical Islam, but rather one of moderate Islam versus radical Islam. What we need to do is embolden the moderates to take on the radicals and perhaps give them a podium, give them the ability, give them the training, whatever they need in order to defeat these forces. And I think Saudi Arabia being this epicenter, being the place where radical Islam and Wahhabism have been exported for decades, to have a victory there would have immeasurable consequences in terms of our battles against radical Islam around the rest of the world.
You know, before the United States was complaining to the Saudis about Saudi support for terrorism, do you know who was complaining to them? The Pakistanis. President Musharraf was complaining about what's happening at the madrasas with Saudi funding. You know who else complained? The Soviet Union back in Russia back in 1995 was complaining about it. This is not a U.S. problem. This is a global problem.
Well, many thanks to you, Jonathan Weiner, former Deputy Assistant U.S. Secretary of State for International Law Enforcement during the Clinton administration. And I was also speaking to Jonathan Shanzer, a fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy and author of the forthcoming book, Al-Qaeda's Armies, Middle East Affiliate Groups and the Next Generation of Terror. And you can continue the conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on Forums. In a moment, the governor of Connecticut resigns amidst ethics charges. This is On Point. Six months after ethics questions prompted an impeachment inquiry, Connecticut Governor John Rowland has announced his resignation effective July the 1st. The third-term Republican made the announcement in a televised address just 2 hours ago. Rowland was once considered a rising star in the Republican Party. He was the nation's youngest governor when he was elected at age 37 in 1994, and he was considered as a possible running mate for George W. Bush in 2000. But last December, Rowland admitted he'd lied about who paid for renovations to his lakeside summer cottage. He first insisted he'd taken out loans to cover the improvements, but 10 days later admitted that friends, employees and some state contractors had footed the bill. Although he maintained that those helping him had got nothing in return, a Connecticut House committee has been holding hearings to determine whether to recommend impeachment. Here's Connecticut Governor John Rowland with his wife Patty at his side, announcing his resignation earlier this evening.
Patty and I have made a decision that we believe will not only affect our family, but certainly will affect the state of Connecticut. The months leading to this decision have been difficult for all of us. I acknowledge that my poor judgment has brought us here. Effective at noon on July 1st, I will officially step down as governor and pass this honor on to Lieutenant Governor Jody Rell, who is a very fine and a very capable and experienced public servant. She shares many of the hopes and many of the dreams that brought this administration to a third term, and I know you will work with her during this transition. Tonight is both a beginning and an end for me. I first ran for public office 24 years ago because I learned at the kitchen table in the Rowland household that you should always try to give something back to your community, whether it was volunteer service, whether it was being active in your school, or whether it was running for public office. I am thankful to my family for instilling in me the principle that public service to others is a noble cause. My political journey has brought me from the State House to the U.S. Congress, to the governor's office. It's been an incredible, fulfilling journey with a simple goal to help serve the people of Connecticut. And it's the people of Connecticut that I thank for giving me this privilege. Throughout these years, I have never forgotten what the people of Connecticut have given me. I can only hope that when all is said and done, when the dust settles and time casts light back on our time in office, that the people will see that we tried to give something back as well. Through times of prosperity and times of recession, through times of tragedy and times of celebration, we have made much progress together. It's been an incredible honor, and I am pleased to have served you. I am proud that there is new life in our cities, especially in Hartford and Waterbury and Bridgeport and New Haven and in New London. There is new life, there is new hope, and there is new opportunity. What an enormous privilege to work with so many outstanding mayors and business people and elected local officials and clergy and volunteers and the not-for-profit agencies, all focused on making their communities better, all striving to prove that the good in society should outweigh the bad. This has been my motivation for the past 10 years. To lead this great state to even greater expectations and to achieve our fullest potential. And we are indeed on the right path. I hope there have been times when I made you all proud, or made you all smile, or at least piqued your interest in this wonderful institution called government. An ancient proverb says, "We make our plans, but the Lord determines our steps." And indeed, there comes a time in everyone's life when you realize it's time to take a new path. This is our time. Thank you for the opportunity to serve as your governor. God bless you all, and God bless the great state of Connecticut.
That was Connecticut Governor John Rowland announcing his resignation in a televised address just 2 hours ago. Lieutenant Governor Jody Rell will be sworn in as Connecticut's new governor on July the 1st. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jopp, Eileen Amada, Jane Manners, Tamar Murad, Chris O'Connor, John Roberts, James Ross and Karen Schiffman, with help from Cora Peterson. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Julian Marshall, standing in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.